Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the politics behind the just-concluded U.S.-China summit in Palm Springs from Susan Shirk, the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs. We'll discuss Obama and Xi's constructive summit in the context of what the Chinese leader is dealing with at home and what the president has on his plate with revelations about spying on Americans that pale in comparison to the extent that the Chinese government monitors its citizens. Then we'll get an appraisal of the economic issues discussed between the world's two biggest economies and the agreement to curb greenhouse gases causing global warming. Scott Kennedy, the director of the Research Center on Chinese Politics and Business at Indiana University, joins us to discuss the slowdown in the Chinese economy and the new Chinese leader's efforts to break up monopolies and oligopolies in state-owned enterprises. We'll also discuss concerns over the theft of intellectual property from U.S. corporations and the cyber theft of U.S. patents. Then finally, with yet another school shooting involving the tragic intersection of mental illness and easy access to assault weapons, we'll speak with Catherine Newman, professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University and author of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. We'll discuss how a shooter who had a history of mental illness wearing full-body armor with a handgun and an assault rifle with 1,300 rounds of ammunition was able to go on a rampage in Santa Monica College that ended up killing four people. And joining us now is Susan Shirk, who is the director of the University of California's Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation and the Ho-Wee Lam Professor of China and Pacific Relations at the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at the University of California, San Diego. In the Clinton administration, she served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs, and her books include How China Opened Its Door, China, Fragile Superpower, and her latest, Changing Media, Changing China. Welcome to Background Briefing, Susan Shirk.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And both of the leaders who met in Palm Springs and seem to have the purpose, I think, of the meeting in many ways was for them to establish a personal relationship. They've pledged to build a new model of relations. So what do you think that means?
Well, I think they're making it up as they go along. And it's a concept that was proposed by the Chinese side. And at this meeting, Xi Jinping articulated it, and it basically is how to prevent China as the rising power and the United States as the dominant power from coming into conflict, especially military conflict, with one another. You know, the history of these moments of transition when you have a rising power challenging an incumbent power often lead to war. They almost always lead to war. So the challenge that American and Chinese leaders face is how to prevent that from happening.
So why is it incumbent upon the Chinese to bring this up? Surely this is something that the United States should also be concerned with.
Well, yes, the U.S. is, but the Chinese side loves to create these new labels for the relationship. The words, the terms are extremely important to them. Americans are more can-do, practical people. You know, we say, well, let's just get on with it. Let's talk together and figure out what to do. We're less concerned with the concept.
So they like a sort of a structure. Is that to do with that sort of the notion of the five-year plans and all of that stuff, and everything has to have a slogan? And
well, part of it is, you know, Marxist-type ideology where we have the three goods and the five bads and this kind of formulaic language. But historians and cultural scholars would tell you that it goes even further back in Chinese tradition.
So the fact that the president described his sessions with the new President Xi, saying how they were terrific, and they had strolled in the greenery amongst the desert there, and had Friday night they had a dinner of lobster tamales, porterhouse steak, and cherry pie. prepared by the celebrity chef Bobby Flay. And apparently there wasn't much that any U.S. leader could do in terms of cozying up to the previous wooden leader, Hu Jintao. But this new leader appears to be much more easygoing. Is that right?
Well, certainly his temperament appears to be more relaxed, more confident, and so he's not afraid of the informal interaction. He doesn't feel that he has to have his talking points and stick exactly to the talking points the way Hu Jintao did. So, and from what I hear, it really was Xi Jinping who was very keen to accept President Obama's invitation for this kind of informal summit. And it's unprecedented in the relations between the two countries. Even Mao and Nixon didn't have as much one-on-one time together. So, I mean, I wish it had been even longer. It's 8 hours of face-to-face discussion, and there were a small number of key advisors in the room for most of those discussions, but there was some opportunity to go off to take a walk in the desert with just interpreters there. So it's really important because diplomacy is a matter of personal interaction, personal rapport, personal communication. And I think this is a very good way of starting to create that kind of bond between the two leaders that can be very helpful later on when they're trying to solve problems or even address crises.
And again, I'm speaking with Susan Shirk, who is the director of the University of California's Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation and the Ho Mui Lam Professor of China and Pacific Relations at the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at the University of California, San Diego. In the Clinton administration, she served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs, and her books include China, Fragile Superpower, and her latest book is Changing Media, Changing China. So, how much, though, are there two President Xis, the one that talks to the cadres at home within the Communist Party, the ruling party that's under a certain amount of pressure from reformers and has certainly been exposed for the massive kleptocracy at the top, where billions of dollars are being sent abroad, often with the children of the leadership. New York Times, of course, revealed the personal fortunes of some of the top leaders in the billions. So outwardly, he seems business friendly, but inwardly, some people have described him as being a Maoist.
Well, he certainly is trying to rule like a stronger individual leader, and he is using different themes and methods in order to give himself the authority to do some very difficult things, such as to try to control corruption at the top and to undertake a pretty ambitious economic reform. Probably the most important thing going on in China right now is that there are a group of economists and economic officials preparing drafts of a new round of market-oriented reforms that are going to be introduced in the fall. And that's very good news because the reforms stalled out over the past decade under Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao, and instead the state control over the economy increased and big state-owned enterprises became more monopolistic, and the competitiveness of the Chinese economy was reduced. So, and that's related to corruption, too. So it's very, very important from the standpoint of U.S. interests, including business interests, and for the sustainability of Chinese growth that they carry out these economic reforms. So that's good news. There, some of the other things that Xi Jinping has said did give us some cause for concern on the ideological front. It looks like they're cracking down in a way that we haven't seen for really since the Deng Xiaoping era. This is kind of a throwback to Maoism. We don't quite understand what that's all about, and it may be a kind of last gasp of the propaganda apparatus. It's hard to know. But this notion of a China dream that he's talked about, that had a strong nationalist, anti-foreign flavor, it's interesting that at this meeting, he redefined what the China dream is and linked it to the American dream and to the dream of people in other countries, and said that it really is about cooperation with other countries, peace, and finding win-win solutions to problems. So, you know, I like to hear that language. I think that's really very constructive, and I'm sure that President Obama felt the same way.
Well, of course, President Xi, as a young man, spent time with a family in Iowa, but he does seem to have at least strong ties to the Chinese military. His wife, Peng Liyang, is a famous singer, and she's also a major general in the PLA. Didn't he serve as on the military committee as well?
Well, he was a staffer,
right,
for one of the senior-most generals as a young man. He didn't actually serve in the military himself. But you're right that he spent a lot of effort when he first came into office last fall to establish his authority over the military and to build credibility with them. And some of what he's been doing in these maritime territorial disputes may be related to that. But in this summit meeting, I think he made pretty clear by highlighting the importance of military-to-military dialogue with the United States, that he's in charge and he's telling the military, you know, I want you to get out and talk to the American military and stop this kind of worst-case scenario thinking and find ways that our two countries can cooperate on common problems instead of preparing for a military conflict with one another. And China is going to observe U.S.-led military exercises, RIMPAC exercises in Asia next year, which is, you know, a very important symbolic gesture and also a way that the two militaries might start to cooperate on common search and rescue activities or response to humanitarian disasters.
So the pivot that the Obama administration announced towards Asia in many circles was interpreted as a military redeployment away from our disastrous recent history in the Middle East towards Asia. So how much are we responsible for tit-for-tat in the military arena? Are we really making it clear that the pivot to Asia is not about military hegemony? I mean, that's the way it seems to be interpreted.
Well, yes, and I think the Obama administration feels misunderstood, because from the time that it came into office, the goal was to increase U.S. commitment and involvement in the region across the board. Diplomatically, Secretary Clinton's first trip was to Asia, joining in the regional organizations and being more active in them than we had previously. We appointed an ambassador to ASEAN who was actually posted out in the region trying to combat this tyranny of distance so that we would just be more present. And the military piece of this was actually fairly minor. you know, very small numbers of Marines training in Australia and some new refueling and repair, repair facilities in Southeast Asia. So, because of the fact that the Chinese side was behaving somewhat more provocatively in the region and alarmed its neighbors, somehow the whole effort of the pivot or rebalancing came to be viewed as a U.S. military balance against China. And that's really not what it was all about. And this summit is giving both sides the chance to make that clear, to recalibrate their policies, and to emphasize the potential for cooperation.
And hence the discussions about how not to have the present hegemon clash with the rising hegemon.
Right. And, you know, I think the United States is realistic about China's rising power, and we're happy to see that Japan's economy is recovering and India is an important country. Indonesia and South Korea are very large and significant countries. So, you know, I don't think U.S. preeminence or military hegemony in Asia is something that we feel needs to be sustained forever. I mean, I think that's unrealistic myself. What we are hoping is that our participation in the regional system, economically, politically, and militarily, can help the countries in the region cooperate better and prevent them from coming into conflict with one another.
Just in closing, Susan Shirk, as I mentioned in the opening, the president has been preoccupied, presumably, with these stories about NSA wiretapping, and there was a leak to the UK Guardian of a finding where the president, a list of countries that the president wanted to target for US cyber attacks, and that would seem to have been embarrassing for the president on the very eve of when he's apparently going to be talking with the Chinese president about their cyber attacks on the United States. That would seem to undercut what he was saying. But I guess there's another way to look at it, and that is that maybe that this gave the president an opportunity to talk about how much China monitors its own citizens, and what the U.S. is doing in comparison seems to pale.
Well, I think it was poor timing. At a minimum, it was a big distraction. If you look at the press conferences and press briefings, you know, this is the issue du jour, and it's what the journalists wanted to ask questions about. And it does, of course, highlight America's own capabilities to monitor the internet and telephone communications. What the U.S. side was trying to do is to emphasize Chinese theft of commercial secrets and technology of private firms using cyber attacks to steal those kinds of secrets. It really wasn't to have a discussion about the way each of us conducts espionage on one another, because, of course, the Chinese are not the only ones doing that. So we are trying to highlight the fact that this severe effort, major effort, to go after pretty much every firm that's doing business in China to try to get information about what they're doing and take their commercial and technological secrets, that it's very bad news for U.S.-China relations, because it undercuts the support that the business community has provided in the past for U.S. engagement of China. I mean, they're feeling really fed up with China, and that's very bad news for the overall relationship. But you're right, that all the discussion about these other programs, which of course are focused on national security, were a distraction and made clear to the Chinese that what they already know this, of course, because they've hacked into many of these programs, that our capabilities are much greater than theirs.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Susan Shirk.
Okay, my pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Susan Shirk, who is the director of the University of California's Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation and the Homewee Lam Professor of China and Pacific Relations at the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at the University of California, San Diego. In the Clinton administration, she served as Deputy Assistant Director of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs, and her books include How China Opened the Door, China, Fragile Superpower, and her latest, Changing Media, Changing China. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the economic aspects of the China-U.S. summit.
I'm going to get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself. Get you and keep you in my arms evermore. Leave all the others waiting on a faraway
shore. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Scott Kennedy, a professor of political science and East Asian languages and culture at Indiana University and the director of the Research Center on Chinese Politics and Business. He has written extensively about U.S.-China relations, particularly their business and trade relationships. He's the author of The Business of Lobbying in China, and he edited China Crosstalk, The American Debate Over China Policy Since Normalization. He's currently working on two projects that focus on China's participation in international economic regimes and in placing the Chinese political economy in comparative perspectives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Kennedy.
Good to be here, Ian.
And at this summit that just finished in Palm Springs, the President Obama's National Security Advisor, Tom Donilon, made it clear that if the Chinese didn't do something about these cyber attacks, et cetera, targeted against U.S. corporations for their intellectual property, and I believe they even got into the U.S. Patent Office to get advanced information on future products, that he felt that Donilon says it's a difficult problem in the economic relationship and was going to be an inhibitor to the relationship reaching its full potential. He went on to say it's hard to have a comprehensive partnership at the same time that you have large-scale theft underway. Susan Shirk said that the U.S. business community is getting pretty fed up with China. Is that a fact?
It certainly is. Last week, I attended the 40th annual meeting of the U.S.-China Business Council meeting in Washington, D.C., which is the council is one of the premier organizations representing businesses that do business in China. And the primary subject for the day was cybersecurity. And it's something that American businesses are quite concerned about. It's in the way that the Taiwan issue is for Chinese as the stumbling block for the relationship with the U.S., cybersecurity could come to mean for the U.S. that same type of issue, that it's something that has to be addressed in order for there to be progress on just about anything else.
But it's pretty clear that this is a two-way street, right? The United States is not simply unilaterally disarmed in terms of cyber espionage.
Yes, correct. I think what we're seeing is a parallel to the early days of the Cold War in the development of nuclear arms control, where there weren't clear norms of the road. The norms of deterrence and first strike or other types of capabilities weren't clear, and we gradually developed that with the Soviets. And we're in the same days now in which the rules for cyber espionage, for cyber war, for cyber crime aren't clear, and we need to develop those rules of the road. And both parties agreed yesterday and over the weekend to do so. It's a key topic of the strategic and economic dialogue, and we'll see this as a central topic at a variety of global fora as well.
So, in terms of what the both leaders have referred to as a constructive summit, what's the takeaway here, and how much is this agreement that they have on addressing global warming and curbing CO2 emissions, which of course China has now surpassed the United States. That means that most of what's up there already is what the U.S. has put up over the last few decades, but what's going to be up there in the future is what the Chinese are putting up, right?
Absolutely. I wouldn't focus on any specific agreements that come out of this meeting as deliverables as what's important for the meeting. I think what we should take away from the meeting is the meeting itself, and this was an informal gathering of the leaders of two very important countries. China's leader for the past 10 years, Hu Jintao, would have been extremely uncomfortable and non-engaging in this type of event. And so it represents a change for China's leadership, and China recognizes that its economic model that it's followed the last several decades isn't going to work. And at the same time, it's had problems within China with regard to environmental pollution, with inequality, et cetera. It's also caused them a lot of problems globally with its trading partners, including the United States. And I think this was the way that Obama wanted to have a reset in the relationship with Russia when he came into office. This meeting is part of a resetting of the relationship between the two sides most broadly, including on economic issues.
Again, I'm speaking with Scott Kennedy, professor of political science and East Asian languages and culture at Indiana University and the director of the Research Center on Chinese Politics and Business. He's written extensively about U.S.-China relations, particularly their business and trade relationships, and he's the author of The Business of Lobbying in China, and he edited China Crosstalk, The American Debate Over China Policy Since Normalization. But in terms of what's happening to the Chinese economy, which has been driving global growth, and I guess it's dependent upon consumption, which is slowing down clearly in Europe. Maybe it's feebly coming back here in the United States. I believe consumption's also slowing down in China itself. But now China has signs of some real signs of their growth rate slowing.
I think there's obviously some serious cyclical issues that are occurring in the global economy in Europe, elsewhere, in Japan. But I think the focus of policy in China now is addressing the structural problems that affect their growth over the medium to long term. And the type of investment and export-led growth strategy that they've had the past few decades is going to be of declining benefit for them. And they realize that, and that they need to focus on developing a much more innovative economy in which consumption by Chinese consumers is much more important than consumption by American consumers or investment by Chinese companies. There's going to be plenty of those they're going to need, but those won't be the future drivers of Chinese growth. And so that's what they're doing, is in the middle of a cyclical slowdown, also addressing a structural problems. And so so they've been willing to sacrifice some short-term growth to help push the economy onto a new development path. So I don't think the Chinese leaders yet are too worried that their economy is growing too slowly. I think if it were to go under 7%, then the alarm bells in Beijing would go off. But I think they're, for the time being, they're concerned. And for us, we got to get used to this that slower Chinese growth isn't going to necessarily mean a re-ratcheting up of investment and expansion of credit to state-owned enterprises.
Well, apparently, President Xi told Obama that the 7.7% growth in GDP was achieved in the first quarter, and that pace is beneficial to adjusting the economic structure and improving the quality of and returns of economic growth. He went on to say, while fully seeing the optimistic prospects for the Chinese economy, we believe that it also faces some risks and challenges. Overall, these risks can be generally held in check. We are taking focused steps to further avert and diffuse them. What are these risks that he's talking about?
Sure. Well, China has built up a great deal of debt in the wake of the global financial crisis. They had a $4 trillion Chinese dollar stimulus package, which was critical for them from sliding into recession, but it led to a buildup of debt and inequality. They also have, shrinking profit margins because where they dominate in manufacturing and assembly, the margins from that are shrinking, and they have to move out of that. China, obviously, for anyone who's ever been there or watched on TV, has huge environmental problems that they have to address, which also cuts into growth. And so these are all things that the Chinese government needs to tackle. And I think they recognize that these are huge problems, and they're beginning to develop a blueprint to address them in a way that they haven't in the past. We can't say for sure that policies coming out of the new government are going to be wholly different from what we've seen in the past, but they've given pretty strong signals the past few months since Xi took power as head of the party, and that they're going to be doing things that are different in promoting consumption, reducing restrictions for Chinese to move about and work in different parts of the country to make reforms in education and the financial markets, which should help lead to more efficient growth, cleaner growth, things that we as Americans will also benefit from as well.
Well, it seems that while the new Chinese leader is cracking down on dissent at home, the brother-in-law of the Nobel Peace Prize laureate was just arrested. He also appears to be going after vested interests in the economy and wants to break up the monopolies and oligopolies of these state-owned enterprises, which I take it have lobbies of their own, right, or certainly inertia of their own.
Well, certainly the Communist Party has focused on making the Chinese economy much more competitive and productive the last few decades. The previous leadership that was in power from 2002 to 2012 made it their primary focus to support state-owned enterprises and give them much easier access to credit and a whole host of other benefits. That obviously helped make China the manufacturing powerhouse it is today to some extent, but it also built up a bunch of problems. And these folks who were enriched also, they become the stakeholders and interest groups that you have to tackle. I don't think that the new leadership, Xi Jinping, are going after state-owned enterprises as their first priority. I think what they're going to do is try and shape the overall environment of the economy to make it generally more competitive and to free up interest rates for loans, to open the capital accounts, to free up prices for energy and other utilities. And those things ought to require state-owned enterprises, like everyone else, to be more efficient and productive. And then I think you'll see expansion of access into state-dominated sectors by private and foreign companies following on that.
But how does he do with the sort of deal with President Xi, the structural corruption there? Because, you have obviously, as state-owned enterprises transfer or morph into private enterprises, there's tremendous potential for even more corruption than there already is. Look at Russia that went through that same evolution, where vast state enterprises were basically taken over for pennies on the dollar, and overnight billionaires were created. Now, there's clearly a lot of corruption there, and it's deeply entrenched and
goes China
right to the top.
By any measure, China has a great deal of corruption. I think, and given how China has done over the last 30-some years in terms of its economic growth, China is one of the strange examples of a country that proves you can grow as fast as anyone while having extensive amounts of corruption, theft of IPR, amazing amounts of pollution, and poor protection of other property rights. But that formula isn't going to work. Their strategy for dealing with corruption now isn't necessarily much different from previous administrations. They've put someone who's very authoritative, Wang Qishan, head of that job, and they are trying to force state-owned enterprises, the military, and others to limit their amount of spending on gifts and banquets and other types of things.
Right. Instead of 12 courses, then now mandating what, five courses at banquets?
Exactly. So, and it's hurt the flower business and the gift giving business, watch business. But they're not doing really what most of us outside analysts believe that they really need to do to deal with corruption, which is to have greater external sources of accountability, including a more independent judiciary, a freer press. Those type of outside eyes and ears which can hold officials accountable. Now, you've seen some of that through social media and some of the press, but it's not systematic, and really it's still in the party's hands to crack down on corruption, and it's hard to have, when you're the ones that are corrupt, to be responsible for yourself. So while we may see some short-term and maybe medium-term improvements in the question of corruption, until they allow more systematic external accountability mechanisms, I don't see them really making fundamental progress on this.
Well, just in closing, Scott Kennedy, clearly because of the breaking stories over the NSA snooping on American citizens, the revelation of the PRISM project, and the extent to which there was an embarrassment to the president with the release of a finding, presidential finding, targeting other countries for cyber attacks on the very eve that he's lecturing the Chinese about it. But there's another way to look at it. Susan Shirk was suggesting that I think it probably tells the Chinese. She feels it tells the Chinese how much more sophisticated the United States is in terms of its cyber ability. So clearly, both sides are involved in this stuff. Do you think there's going to be you were saying earlier it's like the Cold War that took a while for them to come up with an arms control regime. Do you think that there will be a truce or something? I mean, what do you do? I have to tell you, Scott, my website, ianmouse.com, is under persistent, sophisticated cyber attack at the moment, and it's an absolute nightmare trying to keep it going. So, I'm very, obviously, a very unhappy person about cyber attacks.
Sure. Well, I always congratulate you. It at least shows that you're getting some respect, deservedly so. I think that, I don't think what people are suggesting is that, cyber espionage and crime is going to be eliminated. I think what people are suggesting, and all of you and me and all of us outsiders, we're all sort of walking around in the dark in terms of knowing, beyond thinking, that the worst is going on, we really don't know. But in general, one would expect that there's going to, besides the level of sophistication, which I don't know if it's really that much different between the two sides. I would say probably the biggest difference is that there's a greater blurring of the lines in China between cyber industrial espionage and cybercrime, and national security cyber-oriented warfare. And I think in the U.S., those things are probably much more distinctly separated. And part of the ideas of developing rules of the road may be, to some extent, reduce the levels of this activity, but also get the two states focused on dealing with real criminal behavior in a constructive way, and then developing rules of the road for on other issues so that this doesn't become a headache. Obviously, we're going to spy on each other, whether it's electronically or not, but we ought to, you know, and that's been going on for eons, but we ought to make it so it's not something that is entirely problematic for the two societies at large.
But what about the idea that there's, you know, if American corporations can't keep their own secrets, the same applies to the government. And if the Chinese are able to get into the patent office and look at future designs, one way to address that problem isn't that on us to some extent? Aren't our protectors of our secrets incompetent?
I think there's a capacity issue, technical and, you know, organizational, for us to manage, that we'll need to deal with. I'm sure the Chinese as well. And it could have some extent an effect on how much the U.S. invests in China or the type of products we develop. I have pretty good confidence in American ingenuity and entrepreneurs, and even for the amount of IPR that is stolen, usually the innovators have a first mover advantage. That's obviously shrinking for a lot of reasons, including cyber theft. I can't say that I'm super optimistic that we're going to make progress on this quickly, but I still am optimistic about the U.S. economy overall and the strengths that we have. And hopefully we can keep this relatively reined in and from, you know, further exploding and deteriorating.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Scott Kennedy.
We're happy to be here.
Do a follow-up, I'm sure. Again, I've been speaking with Scott Kennedy. He's a professor of political science and East Asian languages and cultures at the Indiana University and the director of the Research Center on Chinese Politics and Business. He has written extensively about U.S.-China relations, particularly their business and trade relationships, and he's the author of The Business of Lobbying in China, and he edited China Crosstalk, the American Debate Over China Policy Since Normalization. He's currently at work on two projects that focus on Chinese participation in international economic regimes and is placing the Chinese political economy in comparative perspective. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the deadly intersection between mental illness and the availability of assault weapons. And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And we've been trying to get through to Catherine Newman, the Dean of the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences and Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University. She's the author of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. I spoke to her previously twice before going on the air. It's very mysterious why she's suddenly unavailable. But we're fortunate to have on the line Paul Helmke, who is the former president of the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence and currently a professor of public policy at Indiana University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Helmke.
Yeah, always good to be on the show. Thank you.
And again, we've had this tragic intersection, Paul, of a history of mental illness and the easy access to assault weapons. I know for you, given the decades you've worked on this issue, and you've been the mayor of a major city of Fort Wayne, Indiana, and we're head of mayors against gun violence, this is like a broken record or a bad movie. But what's your reaction to what just happened in Santa Monica?
Well, obviously another tragedy, and again, we do nothing as a country in response to these tragedies. I mean, we've done nothing since Newtown. It makes us all wonder what's it going to take for us to have Congress do something. We're looking obviously still a lot of the details in the Santa Monica shooting, but clearly there was some history here. Clearly, this is a person that shouldn't have had easy access to guns, and the photos I've seen of his arsenal shows that that's something somebody in the military should be having, to have a semi-automatic assault rifle, to have those high-capacity ammunition magazines, to have that much ammunition in the first place. That's something other countries would not allow, but in this country, we make it pretty easy.
Well, he had, all told, 1,300 rounds of ammunition.
Mm-hmm. And it's... And again, this is someone, at least based on the early reports, that there was a history where this is that he shouldn't have been able to get these things, and where he got them and how he got them. At least I haven't read the details yet. And California is a state that does have some strong gun laws, but one of the problems with just single states having strong gun laws is it's fairly easy to get those guns and that kind of ammunition in states like Nevada, in states like Arizona, and in bordering states. And again, we don't know where he got these, but that's the sort of individual that should not be able to get that kind of weaponry that easily. And really, I think we can raise a serious question whether anyone needs that kind of ammunition with that kind of firepower at any time.
So the consistency here is that the Colorado shooter, the recent Colorado shooter, is actually pleaded insanity in his case. And he was clearly under psychiatric supervision, but yet nothing was apparently done to prevent him doing what he did. Going back to Virginia Tech, the shooter there had a history of mental illness, yet he was able to purchase firearms. And then, of course, the hideous shooting of the children at Sandy Hook in Connecticut. That young man was clearly troubled, although, again, the problem seems to be here that either there's a breakdown in the professional the ability of professionals to intervene, and I guess the resistance of families to face up to how problematic their own children are.
Right. There's really a number of issues here. One is clearly we don't do enough in this country with regard to mental health and treatment of mental health, early identification of it, having the resources available to families, to schools, to others that might spot this, requirements, the ability to give treatment and requirements that somebody get treatment. We need to do a lot more as a country in strengthening our mental health system. But the standard for buying guns for someone with mental health issues is very low. It's not much of a standard at all in this country. In 1968, Congress passed a gun control bill that says that if you were, the phrase they used, if you're a mental defective, you shouldn't be able to buy a gun. And that's been defined since that time in the regulations as someone who has been found by a court or a court-like body to be a danger to themselves or others. So that's a pretty high standard to meet to be disqualified. The catch is that that even when someone meets that standard, like the Virginia Tech shooter, unless the state sends those records into the background check system, which Virginia did not do, and unless we require there be a background check for every sale, which we don't do, most sales that by so-called private sellers, particularly at gun shows, they don't have to do a background check, then that sort of person is going to be able to easily get the gun anyway. So, yes, let's fix the mental health system. Yes, let's have a tighter standard for who can get a gun. Yes, let's make sure we check that sort of stuff every time we do a sale. you know, the one thing I've always pointed out, if somebody wants to get a job at McDonald's or at any fast food restaurant or maybe mow somebody's grass, generally you're going to ask, you know, will your neighbor give you a recommendation? Will your school, your high school teacher or grade school teacher give you a recommendation? We want to make sure somebody that's working in the fast food industry or mowing our yards, at least somebody can vouch for them. To get a gun in this country, to get all sorts of guns with serious firepower, nobody has to vouch for you. You don't have to go through any sort of procedure like that. And I think we should look at have those sorts of tests or some sort of requirements before someone can so easily get a gun and all that ammunition in this country.
Well, let's bring in John Donahue, who is a professor of law and economics at Stanford Law School. He's also written extensively on crime and gun control issues. John, how does this shooting in Santa Monica College, yet another rampage with a heavily armed shooter with full body vests, 1,300 rounds of ammunition, an assault rifle, and a handgun, with a history of mental illness? I mean, we keep hearing this. They keep coming back to us. What's your reaction to it?
Well, much needs to be understood about the details of the case to fit it into the broader package. But again, it's another indication of what is a sadly common problem. Even though these events are relatively rare, the problem is that the United States sort of leads the world in these sorts of episodes, and they seem to be increasing in frequency. And in many respects, I think it shows that the thrust of American thinking about guns has been misguided for some time, and really steps need to be taken to turn around this sort of NRA mentality of guns for all and bring us in line with the other Western industrialized nations that do take, more assiduous and careful and effective steps at limiting who has access to this very serious firepower.
Well, there's a Swedish student interviewed at Santa Monica College during the rampage, and she said she was going to go home. She thinks America's too dangerous a country to live in.
Yeah, I mean, as countries go, we're homicidally dangerous compared to all other Western industrialized nations. Thankfully, we're not as bad as third world countries. So if you're willing to travel in Latin America, the United States looks pretty good. But it is shameful that a country of our wealth has a homicidal violence problem at the level that we do. No other rich country in the world has the homicide levels that we have, and of course it's predominantly fueled by gun violence. And unfortunately, a certain segment of the population has a wish to believe that guns make you safer. But the fact of the matter is, if we could be massively less gun saturated in this country, there's no question that the homicide rate would go down. Unfortunately, the rise of the sort of militant wing of the conservative legal analysis of the Constitution has given us a straitjacket to some degree with the Second Amendment decision,
so,
which I think has been an unfortunate trend, and hopefully we can stop further efforts to shackle wise and sensible gun policies at the constitutional level going forward.
Well, Paul Helmke, again, former president of the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence and currently professor of public policy at Indiana University. The ironically, of course, the shooter's name is similar to that of the head of Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, and of course, that is irrelevant. But on the other hand, we spend so much money and so much attention, and Homeland Security spent $1 trillion on preventing terrorist incidents that are very few and far between, and they take up the entire attention of the country. Yet, repetitively, we have these massacres of Americans, killing Americans, and nothing is done. So I find that I'm in an alternative universe here. Does it trouble you?
Quite clearly. You look at the number of people that were killed on 9/11, we've surpassed that figure by far in terms of the gun violence in this country. 33 people are murdered with guns every day in this country. There's another 80 or so that are injured every day. When you add in the suicides with guns and accidents with guns, you've got a horrendous figure. Our emergency room physicians, surgical doctors are doing a lot better job at keeping these people alive. So sometimes it looks like the gun deaths are going down, but actually the shootings are staying up at a pretty high level. And again, as you said, the response from our elected officials is to do nothing. And that's the amazing thing. After 9/11, all sorts of things get passed right away, and you know, we're not questioning some of the things that that were done in to fight the war on terror. But in terms of trying to reduce gun violence in this country, all we seem to do is say, let's get more guns. And as John just said, but my one comment is, if more guns made us safer, we'd be the safest country in the world, because we've got more guns per capita than at least any other industrialized first world country. And it's not making us safer. It's putting us all at risk, and something does need to be done about it.
Well, I thank both of you gentlemen for joining us here today at the last minute. Paul Helmke, a professor of public policy at Indiana University and the former president of the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, and John Donahue, the third, a professor of law at Stanford Law School and research associate in the National Bureau of Economic Research. He has written numerous publications on gun control policy and is the author of Shooting Down, The More Guns, Less Crime, Shooting Down the More Guns, Less Crime Hypothesis. So I hope we don't have to have this conversation again, gentlemen, but I fear we will.
Yeah, I'm afraid we will, but good to chat.
And thank you again, Paul.
And thank you, Ian, for focusing on this issue. It's important that we talk about this, not just when a shooting occurs, but almost every day till something gets done here.
Well, again, thank you both, gentlemen. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.